Greetings, everybody. Hey, welcome to one of those kind of special edition TFMR podcasts. It's Thursday. We usually have an access to access webinar, but I wanted to stay a little more focused today rather than, you know, kind of a wide ranging discussion just because of the events of the last couple of weeks. And things could take you in all sorts of different directions and you could make all kinds of conclusions. And I wonder if we can sort through this and come up with some kind of general consensus about what might be coming next across the stock market, the bond market, the precious metals, all that kind of stuff. So I thought the best person I could talk to in talking this out would be Denver Dave. Most of you know Dave Kranzler. He's been doing this even longer than I have, running blogs and then his experience on Wall Street and working the bond markets. Dave's current job is he's a hedge fund manager, but he also has his fabulous subscription services, both of which you should check out because it could not be more timely. A short seller's journal, where if you think the market is overvalued, well, geez, who isn't looking for good things to short? Then also the mining stock journal. I mean, if we're back to an era where we're closing in on the end of the great Keynesian experiment and the shares and the metals are going to rally, well, then we all need good mining shares and mining share research as well. So please check out Dave's services and thank him for spending some time with me today. Dave, thanks. I appreciate it.
Hey, Craig, thanks for having me on. I'm glad to see someone thinks I know what I'm talking about. That doesn't mean that I do.
I'm your one-person fan club, Dave. It's like the old... I'm reminded of the
old... I'll just throw the brown stuff against the wall and we can watch it slide down.
Perfect. It's like Rodney Dangerfield used to have a line. Yeah, it's been a rough week, you know. My fan club broke up. The guy died. So anyway, that would I'm your one person fan club, Dave. All right, so here's the deal.
Don't die. Please don't die.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that. I'll try to hang on as long as I can, though they're killing me. I can tell you that with everything that's going on. David, all right, so here's the deal. We saw what was just wildly unusual, if that's the right way to put it. And you and I traded some stuff on Twitter and some emails into the end of January where the stock market was just going up. Remember those charts? I mean, it was like a 45-degree angle up every day.
And it was ridiculous.
And then remember the very last day, that Friday, the 26th or whatever, the intraday was 45 degrees straight up. And you and I were, yeah, we were trading stuff back and forth going, this is just ridiculous. Okay, so then what happened? We got that BLSBS on the 2nd. Everybody wanted to focus on average hourly earnings, not the whole combined work week and weekly earnings. And that was used, I guess, as a rationale. It's far more complicated than this. But bond yields got to 290 or so on the 10-year. Stock market fell 665 points. It then fell 1,000 points on two separate occasions last week. So let's start there, Dave. Is this the beginning of the end, kind of like 2008? Or is it instead just another correction and that the stock market is this... you know, this kind of hyper, it's a signal of a symptom of hyperinflation. You know, the number one stock market last year was Venezuela, right? Could the stock market just, you know, go over this speed bump and just keep soaring? I mean, what are you thinking at this point?
Boy, that's a good question. It's really complicated because, you know, my premise all along with the stock market is that, you know, it's a function of all of the money that's been printed, not just by the Fed, but by central banks globally.
Yeah.
And it's also, I do think the Fed steps in and prevents the market from going lower. And so it certainly could turn into something that looks like Venezuela if the Fed wants it to.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like the Fed is in there actually necessarily buying, you know, hand over fist, buying S&P futures or buying ETFs and in some sort of offshore, you know, LLC that's off balance sheet, although they could be. But, you know, with the way that the algos work, all the hedge funds need to know is what, you know, and the Fed could just use the same electronic broker every time it wants to go and send a message to the market. Hey, we've got a floor here. Mm-hmm. And the hedge fund algos see that, and then they just pile in, and it goes straight up.
So right.
Certainly the liquidity is there, in the banking system. I mean, there's still well over $2 trillion of excess reserves sitting in the bank accounts at the banks in their excess reserve account at the Fed. So I'll tell you what, I think a lot of it really kind of boils down to just how serious the Fed is at quote unquote normalizing its balance sheet, whatever that means. I mean, does normalizing it mean, you know, taking it down to where it was before it started its QE program? I think it was around $800 billion at that point.
Yeah.
Or does normalizing it mean taking it back to where it was in the early 70s, where, you know, it had not much of a balance? So, I mean, interestingly, and there's been some other bloggers and alternative media guys who have mentioned it, but the week, I think it was the last week of January or the second to last week of January, the Fed let $21 billion bleed off of its balance sheet. And then, coincidentally, the market peaked on January 26th and started heading down. I think it was January 26th. No, that's when
it peaked on about the first. Well, that peak though on the 26th was that day that we were just finally just incredulous of what we were seeing.
Yes, and so whether or not if it's coincidental that the Fed happened to remove or let $21 billion bleed off its balance sheet or not, and then the stock market tanked like that. I think part of the problem is everything in the system is so tightly wound with, inverse VIX funds and the hedge fund algos and margin debt. And it's like, if the hedge funds get a whiff of weakness in the market, they start selling.
Yeah, and they pull their bids.
I think what we saw in the first week of February was an unleashing of all of the, just unwinding of over-levered positions in the stock market, ETFs, inverse VIX funds, people going long VIX and dumping stocks. I mean, a lot of these risk parity funds, every time the stock market starts to move down and volatility goes up, they have to rebalance their funds. And it's been estimated there's about $400 billion in risk parity assets. So can the Fed keep that on Atlas's shoulders? Hold up the market on Atlas's shoulders? But it looks like they've got it stabilized here. So I guess to circle back to the Fed's, I hate the term quantitative tightening, but everyone knows what we're referencing when we use that term. If they stick to their balance sheet unwinding program, I think the stock market's going to get annihilated. So again, a lot of people are out there, a lot of high profile guys are out there writing their articles on the assumption that the Fed's going to follow through on the schedule that it laid out for unwinding its balance sheet. And we haven't really seen it yet. They got behind that $21 billion that they let bleed off. That caught them up with the $10 billion a month run rate. And look what happened.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen when it ramps up to $30 billion a month?
Right.
I don't believe it's going to happen until I actually see it. It's the same thing with interest rates. They've been talking about raising interest rates since 2013. I think they started in October 2014, maybe something like that. They started ratcheting it up 25 basis points every now and then.
And to 15.
They would lay out a schedule for how many rate hikes they were going to do, and they have yet to fulfill that. So, let's see how serious the Fed is at quote unquote normalizing its balance sheet. And if they 100% plan on sticking to that schedule, this stock market's got a lot of downside.
So Dave, I guess that's then the ultimate question. How can they stick to that schedule? You've already got, it was announced, I remember seeing this right at the end of the year last year. This was before there was the Trump budget and all that kind of stuff. Net issuance of treasuries this year with new funding needed and then rolling over existing debt was going to be $1.3 trillion. That's the most since 2010. So you already had that out there. Now Trump rolls out these budget for the next 4 years. Every single one is going to be in excess of $1 trillion of a deficit. So you got that whole new whatever that's going to be, add $5 trillion to the debt. You've already got all of the existing debt moved as short of a maturity as possible to get the lowest interest possible in terms of debt service. So we're already paying about $400 billion a year in a line item if on interest on the national debt. If that goes up, you know, they try to move rates up to 4%, 6%, that's going to go over $1 trillion right there. And then lastly, how many of these hedge funds that, you know, were desperate for yield, so they were, you know, shorting the VIX and doing all that other stuff, but at the same time, buying a basket of treasuries or their notes or whatever, and then margining them, because you can get your maximum bang for the buck margining treasuries, and then going and buying more treasuries and buying more treasuries, trying to maximize getting that leverage. All of those treasuries are going to go underwater. In fact, so a lot of them already are. And so you, all those, yeah, all those things together, Dave, unless the Fed can somehow convince the primary dealers that hold that $2 trillion in reserves to make a constant bid in the bond market, I don't see how they hold it together without totally reversing course. Am I missing? I mean, what am I missing?
You're not missing anything. But just to review the numbers that you tossed out there, those are the numbers that are out there for discussion in terms of how much debt is going to have to be issued and what the spending deficit is going to be. Well, those are based on CBO estimates, right?
Right.
I mean, the CBO, I don't think I've ever seen the CBO ever be right on any of its forecasts in terms of the spending deficit and the amount of debt issuance. They're always way low,
right?
Way low.
And I should add, so Dave, for everybody, Dave, too, they always factor in, you know, some outrageous GDP growth number too,
yeah,
that you know isn't going to be hit. So I just want to make sure everyone's thinking about that too. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, no problem. Well, that brings up another point. I mean, you know, the assumptions underlying, you know, what the spending deficit will be depend on a certain level of tax revenues that come in based on a certain level of GDP. That's not going to happen. I mean, you're already seeing companies, I guess Goldman Sachs said, I saw it in Zero Hedge, they said their corporate buyback list, stock buyback desk, was the busiest it's ever been last week. And you've already had most of these big companies announce that the money they'll repatriate back here is going to be used to buy back stock. They have no reason to put it in CapEx, and if they had CapEx programs they're going to spend money on, we would have seen that show up in the commercial and industrial loan numbers. Commercial industrial loan numbers have been declining all year. So if banks aren't lending, and those are like, you know, CapEx projects that midsize and large corporations borrow to do CapEx projects or put up buildings or whatever. You know, just general CapEx projects. And they do general CapEx projects when they have a reason to do them. Well, we've got excess capacity. You've got, especially now, you've got flatlining to declining demand from the consumer. So, you know, where are the how is the tax cuts going to stimulate the economy? It's not like it's putting a lot of money into the average household's pockets.
Right.
You know, for most middle-class people, the tax cut was neutral, you know, to maybe slightly positive. That's not going to stimulate the economy.
And the debt level, and the consumer debt levels and everything else that are already at extremes.
Record highs, and then you've got consumer debt delinquencies and defaults are starting to ratchet up at a pretty alarming rate. I mean, auto defaults, this is off the top of my head, but I've put the numbers in my short seller's journal quite often, especially in the subprime bucket. They're already at the levels where they were in mid to late 2008, and we haven't even had a financial crisis yet. And credit card delinquencies are now ratcheting up. So, and next is going to be, we're going to start seeing it in mortgages. I can guarantee it.
Dave, I sit here and listen to what you've just added, and I'll be the first to admit, I mean, I wrote all kinds of stuff when I first started my blog in 2010 about, you know, the hyperinflation that was coming and the Fed wasn't going to be able to control it, and, you know, this money printing. And I completely missed completely missed the idea that they, you know, a lot of that, those dollars were being quarantined, you know, and held on bank balance sheets instead. And then, you know, we watched the money velocity drop and all that kind of stuff. Now, though, I just don't see, and again, I guess I didn't see what I was missing in 2010 either. That's why I missed it. But I don't see how here in 2018 and into 19 and beyond, after they've already done, like you said, the $15 trillion worth of QE around the globe, how are they going to be able to continue to finance all of this U.S. debt specifically without the Fed almost losing all credibility by waving off what they had said, you know, everything's fine, we did all this, now we're going to normalize, everything's fine. How does that not turn into just this fiasco now, finally? I'm racking my brain trying to see what I'm missing.
Well, I mean, you're not missing anything. I mean, that kind of gets us back to the point about the CBO projections. I mean, you know, I'm operating on the assumption that the spending deficit is going to end up being a lot wider than the CBO is projected.
Right, right.
So that means they're going to have to issue more debt than the trillion or 1.2 yeah. trillion that they're saying they're going to have to issue this year. Now, what's kind of sneaky about that is we're already 4 months into the government's fiscal year.
Right.
So we won't see a full 12 months of debt issuance until we're 4 months into the next fiscal year. But it will be interesting to see. And then also remember, we're going into tax season, so this is when the government tends to get in a lot of revenues.
Mm-hmm.
People were making a big deal over the fact that the government's spending deficit, or no, the government ran a $48 billion surplus in January, and it brought in, you know, I guess a record level of tax revenues for January. Guess what? The surplus was bigger January a year ago. So even for this January, the surplus was smaller than it normally should have been for a January, because you start seeing, you know, people start filing their taxes in January. I'm guessing a lot of people probably started, you know, because of the tax cuts, I think a lot of people probably deferred recognizing income until this year, so then they file their taxes a little bit early because they can report a lower income for 2017 and get a refund, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we're probably not going to really see what the true run rate of federal debt issuance is until we get into the summer, and that's when I think it's going to get interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of who's going to buy all this debt, I mean, for me, that's a very good question. I mean, up until this point, you know, I mean, China, they've been reducing the amount of treasuries they hold in their reserves. But, I mean, to start buying some of those treasuries, you know, if they want to try and nurture relations with the U.S. government. Japan is essentially our lapdog, so I'm sure they'll continue buying treasuries. But, I mean, the system, and I think we're seeing it, we're seeing the dollar drop and we're seeing interest rates go up.
Yeah.
So I think to some extent, the Fed has lost, is losing control of interest rates on the long end. They can still mostly control the short end interest rates by controlling the Fed funds rate. But even then, they can't completely control it. And, you know, don't beat yourself up about 2010. I mean, we all thought the same thing, that we were going to start seeing rampant inflation. But guess what? There has been inflation. It just hasn't shown up in the government's CPI.
Yeah, that's true, too.
The stock market itself is evidence that there's inflation. The stock market's been inflating. Home prices have been inflating. Home prices, as you know, as a function of the average American household income, are at the highest they've ever been. I mean, that's inflationary.
Yeah.
You know, medical expenses, car insurance.
Yeah. Yep. Rent.
You know, so there's been areas where there's been, you know, double-digit inflation. It just, you know, somehow the government doesn't seem to be able to find those pockets of inflation when it reports its CPI.
So then, Dave, at the end of the day, I mean, I'm having a hard time picturing how that all doesn't turn out this way. I mean, if the Fed doesn't reverse course. And the U.S. government is going to have all this funding need in the next couple of years. I don't see how interest rates on the long end don't skyrocket. That crushes the hedge funds that are long treasuries, right? And demands a margin call. You got that going against you in the market. The higher long rates will just kill mortgage rates. It'll kill home buying. It'll kill the consumer with the credit card debt and all the consumer's existing debt. I'm just keep drawing back to how does this not end badly in the short term? And so, I don't know. I guess I'll just one last thought from you. And then how do we, you know, how do you start buying the miners here? Do you try to be selective about them? Is this a great time to be aggressively adding metal again? What are your thoughts? What are you telling people?
I think really, you know, it's the Fed is kind of in between the same rock and hard place that it's been in for at least 10 years.
Yeah.
So the question is, are they going, you know, do they turn around and keep the system from collapsing by re-upping their money printing? I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, my gut would tell me if they turned around and said, oh, geez, we, you know, matter of national security, we got to start buying these treasuries or, you know, the government's not going to be able to issue this debt. Matter of national security. In fact, I think it was either a current Fed governor or a former Fed governor came out and said, one of these elitists came out just a couple days ago and said that the national debt is a matter of national security.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, does that give them an opening to say, we got to monetize this? In which case, you know, again, my gut would tell me that the world would say the U.S. is bankrupt, let's sell stocks, but you could get a Venezuela situation where it just, you know, soars even higher, or like, you know, what happened in Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
No. I mean, we started seeing that, you know, at the end of January when, you know, the time that you were referencing when we were marveling at the 45-degree uptrend in the Dow. So we started to see the stock market go parabolic.
Mm-hmm.
It's just perplexing. Don't know how that particularly plays out. What I will say, though, is they've got a massive problem on their hands. And, you know, again, just like in 2008, the best thing to do would just let it implode, let the system, reset the system, and let's start over from the ground up. But they're not going to do that. You know, because the other element we didn't even bring in here is the pension problem.
Right.
I mean, I'm making the argument now with Paul Craig Roberts that part of the reason the Fed won't let the stock market go down is that, if a friend of mine who works at a pension fund did a study on public pensions and he stress tested them based on their reported levels of underfunding. They're all way more underfunded than what they publicly report. But he came to the conclusion that if the stock market climbed 10% and stayed down 10% for any kind of continuous time frame, and he defined continuous time frame as 3 to 4 months, that most of these pension funds would blow up.
Yeah.
And if you'll notice, we've now had essentially 3 10% drawdowns since August 2015. There was a 10% drawdown in August 2015, 10% drawdown in, again, these are plus or minus, in January 2016, and at the bottom of last week, there was a 10% drawdown. And then you'll notice that there's been a V recovery. So the 10% drawdown lasted maybe a week or two or 3 or 4. Certainly not the 3 or 4 months that my buddy has determined is the point at which pensions start blowing up. So to me, I almost am wondering if there's kind of a secret official policy of trying to keep the stock market propped up.
Right.
And again,
right.
I don't think ultimately in the long run they're going to be able to do it. They're just going to, either the dollar is going to collapse or interest rates, you know, part of the formula that started the decline last week was the fact that the 10-year hit 285. Well, it was north of 290 last night. So, you know, I think there's so many balls that the Fed's juggling that unless they go back to outright printing and monetizing, you know, I think this thing's gonna collapse, and it might collapse in the next 12 months.
Yeah, I think eventually
in
that's.
Terms of, oh,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I that's just I think eventually that's the same thing. That's the same point I keep coming back to, Dave. Is how do they not? How do they not do it? How does that not? How is that not the end result?
I think that's right. Whether it happens in the next year or the next, you know, 3 years is you know, that's impossible to time that, because there's just so much market intervention. It makes forecasting almost impossible.
Yeah.
But in terms of gold and mining stocks, you know, again, you hate to sound like a broken clock, but you know, in terms of the relative value of mining stocks, it's one of the cheapest asset classes in the stock market right now.
Right.
If not the cheapest. And the mining stocks right now, after this latest sell-off that we've had in the sector, they are almost as cheap relative to the price of gold as they were in December 2015 when the sector bottomed and kind of this new next leg of the bull market started. So I actually thought, as did, you know, several of my fellow colleagues, I thought we were going to see a sell-off last week in gold, just based on the open interest and the structure of the commitment of traders, and we didn't. But I don't, you know, the open interest is still well over 500,000 contracts, and normally, you know, we don't start higher until they get it down around, you know, 420, 430,000 contracts. You know, will this time around be different? I don't know. But I'd probably wait for just to see what happens while China's gone for the week, right? China's starting last night.
Chinese New Year.
Off for a week to celebrate their Lunar New Year. And so it will remove some bid in the market for physical gold. I don't think it completely removes it, because I think they have trading desks they keep open in London. And even as it's been rising in price, and I get those from the premiums that are being paid for imported gold over in India from Brimlow's report, which I think you get, or at least you're familiar with. You know, I think if you don't own any gold, you know, I think now's a good time, gold and silver certainly, and you don't own any mining stocks, now's probably a good time to just sort of wade slowly into the market. I mean,
yeah.
You don't have to buy it all at once, and you're not going to miss, you know, if you miss a 10% move, we're talking about a move ahead of us, especially if all these other factors come into play that we've been discussing about the fiscal situation and economic situation in this country. I mean, you know, you could easily see over the next 3 to 5 years, gold could double or triple.
Yeah.
And if that happens, I mean, you know, the Huey is at 186 right now. I mean, we could easily see the Huey go to 1,000 if gold were to double or triple from here. So, you know, I think you can afford to, if you don't own any, you just afford to wait in slowly. You know, we might get a correction next week. We might not. And just sort of buy it slowly over time. If you're already long, I'd probably just wait a week or two and see if we get some type of corrective pullback from the move we saw last week and yesterday, and then start buying again. So,
Dave,
that's
kind
of my outlook for the precious metals and the mining stocks.
Yeah, and I concur. I keep telling people on this site that this feels a lot like where we were in 2010. You know, and silver for the first half of 2010 was sideways, $17 or $18. It didn't really start to go until QE2 was announced in November of that year. Then it got into the 20s by January, and then went to 48. And then gold got all the way to 1900 at the time. Remember in August of 2011, we had the U.S. being downgraded by S&P, and we had all of the other things that were factoring in at that point, other crises. And I just wonder if, we're not headed on that same kind of timeline again. I tell you what, my friend, I think we've been at this for a half hour, so I think we, out of respect for your time, we'll stop here. But I got a sneaky feeling we might want to maybe do this on a, you know, quarterly basis, because this is going to be crazy. And obviously, I think anybody listening can tell we have more questions than answers at this point. and it's beneficial.
Sure, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, it's beneficial to kind of talk it out, you know? And so anyway, in the meantime, everybody can find your stuff, Investment Research Dynamics, where we find the Short Sellers Journal and the Mining Stock Journal, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And it's a subscription service, and you put out information how frequently?
The Short Seller Journal, I do weekly, and the Mining Stock Journal, I do every other week.
Okay. At a time, as we began, I mean, if we're talking about maybe the stock market having some tough sledding, okay, it's a good idea to know what some good shorts are. And if we're talking about the Fed losing control and it being a lot like 2010, well, Mining Stock Journal is going to help you pick the good stuff from the bad stuff. And so I think both services are extraordinarily valuable at this point. Dave, I tell you what, my friend.
Well, thanks, Greg. I appreciate it.
I'm your one-man fan club. All right, pal.
Just don't die.
Hey, let's do this again soon. For now, though, we'll just see where we go from here. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, and I'd love to do it again. I'd do it quarterly for sure.
All right, everybody. Hey, and thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope you found this at least mildly helpful as a couple of old farts sit there and try to sort through this stuff. Dave, have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. You too, Craig.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening.